This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Arbella Studios' Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it!
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. We recently marked the anniversary of D-Day, the day of the Normandy invasion that was the largest amphibious military operation in history. And you'll recall it was Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower who gave the order for that Allied assault in 1944, which ultimately led to our triumph over Hitler during World War II. Now, Eisenhower, of course, went on to become our 34th president as well. But while his military and political accomplishments are well known, not so much is known about Eisenhower's Christian faith. So we're going to talk about that today with Alan Sears. He is founder of Alliance Defending Freedom, which he led as president, CEO, and general counsel for 23 years. Alan also has served in numerous positions in the Reagan and Bush administrations and is out now with a new book on Eisenhower's faith. It is called The Soul of an American President. And it's so good to have you here, Alan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Janet, it's always great to be with you. I appreciate you so much. And one of the things I know about everybody that talks about Janet Bedford is they always know where she stands.
Well, that is very kind of you to say, Alan. I'll take that as a compliment. But I have much, much respect for you as well. We love Alliance Defending Freedom, and it's just an honor to have you here, and especially on this subject.
God's been very good.
Yes, he certainly has. I think this is a very interesting book, and I think it is true that this has been an untold story about Dwight Eisenhower's faith. And I'm wondering, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that one of the issues is, of course, the time that he was in, the way that he felt about God was normal. He probably, I don't have an exact count, but he probably referred to the Lord in very specific ways, publicly proclaimed the importance of faith and these issues more than any other president.
Wow.
We haven't done a word count, but I can tell you we've done a review of lots and lots of speeches. We've read, and only part of these are digitized now, so it's a little harder to do this work. But the way he talked about the Lord, the way his faith and his dependence grew over time, was really very fitting of that era. And you remember the 50s were a time when there was the Cold War hanging over people's heads, when there were a lot of threats and so forth. And Dwight Eisenhower referred to what America had is spiritual weapons. He said we're in a fight between light, between truth and darkness. And when he would compare us to the Soviet Union or the communist Chinese and the things going on across the world after World War II, he really recognized after his experiences in World War II that the only real hope, the only real solution lay at the foot of the cross. Hmm. And he spoke about it early and often, but as they say, I think it was considered so normal at the time that it just didn't stand out to historians until we went back and took another look at it.
Yeah, well, it was interesting to me when you talked about his family background and the fact that his grandfather was a River Brethren minister and his parents were committed members of that community. And I think for a lot of listeners, they'll say, what in the world is the River Brethren community? Not really sure what that is all about.
Well, that stream of faith still exists in America, but they were a part of the Mennonites. Of course, Menon was a former priest in Europe who left the church, had entered into a number of different efforts and so forth, and finally, out of that came what we now call the modern Mennonite movement.
Yeah.
And of course, that had several streams of faith, and one of those was the River Brethren. It's sort of attributed that maybe they got that name because they used a river to baptize in. But that was the Eisenhower strain. And then some tragedy came into his family's life. His mother and father lost a child. And they had some people suggest that there was another solution besides the River Brethren faith. And they took a detour, which President Eisenhower and his brothers did not follow.
Right. So the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is quite a shift.
Quite a shift. But one of the things that stayed strong throughout his childhood was his mother's faith, even though she departed from what we might call traditional Protestant or evangelical beliefs, she still believed the Bible was the source of God's word. And she hammered that Bible into all of her sons. And Dwight read the Bible all the way through as a young boy, and then he read it a second time. And one of the things we found out later on in life is that he remembered those Bible verses, and he would use them from time to time in context in the right place, unlike some politicians that give you the verse backwards. My favorite thing is when you have a politician who attributes a verse to the Bible that God hasn't heard of yet.
I know. That's true. They do that a lot.
We'll leave names unmentioned.
Right. That's true. That's very interesting to me, because you say in the book that he actually was not baptized until after his inauguration and didn't join the church. It was the National Presbyterian Church he eventually joined?
Yes, because of his family background, he wasn't baptized as a child or as a young man. And so, very interestingly, as his faith became more and more important to him, which he described as basically the way that he got through the final years of his command in World War II. In fact, when he gave an interview with Clara Booth Luce, he talked about how he could not have ordered thousands of men to go to their death if he couldn't go down to his knees and talk to God and beg for support. But he realized that he needed to be part of a fellowship. And interesting dichotomy of life. When he was nominated for presidency, a lot of people came to him, advisors, is again talking about modern politicians, and they said, well, how can you be elected in America if you're not a member of a church and if you don't go to a church? And he said, I'm not going to do anything for political reasons.
Wow.
But he agreed with them and with Billy Graham, who had become a good friend, that he should be a church member. So after the election, after he's inaugurated, which, by the way, he interrupted, and the only president to ever do this, he prayed a prayer during his inaugural talk that he himself wrote.
Wow.
Some others have done it, but it was speechwriter work. And then just a few days after the inaugural, he walked over to the National Presbyterian Church. He publicly proclaimed Christ as his Savior, went through the words of the Presbyterian order of worship at that time, was baptized, was confirmed, and received into membership. And Janet, essentially from then until his death, when he was physically able to do it, not prevented by health problems or by travel issues, he was in church every Sunday.
Wow.
And ultimately, by his retirement, he was a regular part of four congregations, depending on which part of the country he was at the different parts of the year.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you talk about the fact that he often would keep his faith sort of private, and there would be parallels, I would imagine, for a lot of people between him and Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan didn't regularly go to church the way that Eisenhower did. Is that correct?
That's right. President Reagan, one of the things he talked about, of course, was the security issue. He didn't want to disrupt people by going to services. But many people may not know this. When Ronald Reagan was in his last years, when he was retired and living out in Los Angeles, his pastor came to his office on Monday morning and privately went through the sermon he had done on Sunday before.
Oh, wow.
because to the president, it was very important not just to read the Word of God on his own or to pray on his own. He needed spiritual guidance and wisdom. And this also happened with Eisenhower. I don't want to give away the whole book, Janet.
Sure.
But one of the things that happened after he left the White House, one of his very best friends became his pastor in Gettysburg, which is where Mamie and he owned the first house they'd ever owned. They bought a little farm and restored the farmhouse outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. near the battlefields, and they were in that church every Sunday. They were at Gettysburg.
Wow.
And the pastor and he would meet for many times on a weekly basis.
Well, I'll tell you what, hang on, Alan, just a moment. We do need to pause for a quick break. Alan Sears with us. The Soul of an American President is his book, and we'll be right back on Janet Meffer Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. How much is one life worth? Most of us would say life is priceless, and we'd be right. After all, what is the value of someone created in the image of God? We're asking Janet Meffer Today listeners, just like you, to help us save babies through the ministry of Preborn. How does Preborn save babies? Through ultrasounds. Preborn works with hundreds of pro-life pregnancy centers across America, providing free ultrasounds for women in crisis pregnancies. And 80% of the time, when a mother sees her little baby on an ultrasound, she'll choose life. It's that easy. We need your help to support the vital work of Preborn in saving human lives. For your gift of $28, you can provide a free ultrasound to a mom in a crisis pregnancy. And for a gift of $140, you can provide 5 ultrasounds to 5 mothers. All you have to do is call 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you for saving a baby's life. We are back on Janet Meffer Today, and it's my delight to have with us Alan Sears, the founder of Alliance Defending Freedom, and formerly with the Reagan and Bush administrations. He's out with a great new book. It's called The Soul of an American President, The Untold Story of Dwight D. Eisenhower's Faith. And we were chatting a little bit, Alan, before we went to the break, about how Dwight D. Eisenhower went to church and kind of the road that he took. One of the interesting things is, I'm sure many people will wonder how his Christian faith impacted him as he was growing up. Because here he was, he grew up in poverty in Denison, Texas, ended up going to West Point. And as you say in the book, he spent a lot of years kind of meandering to different assignments in the military and wondering really what his purpose was. And I'm sure never could have imagined where he would have ended up. But what about those years? What kind of impact did his faith in Christ have on him during that period of his life?
Well, I think it gave him a solid foundation. And one of the things that I know from my own life, as I talk to you today, I'm 67 years old, and I know about how the Lord brought me on a long journey through the different phases of my life. And even though from time to time I may have wavered from where I should have been, or gotten engaged in certain things I shouldn't have done, I always knew what the truth was. And probably nobody listening would know what I'm talking about. I say facetiously, but he knew the foundational truths. At West Point, he was involved in a Bible study there. I talked to some of the Army chaplains, and they said it was very difficult in that period of time. Most people did not either register to vote or belong to an organized church when they were going from post to post, being transferred in that era around before and after World War One. Quite a bit different way of living than people do today. But he had a number of tragedies in his life. He and Mamie lost their first child.
Yes.
Through some real hardship, and they had a period of time when they separated. He went to Panama in pre-air conditioning days. She was from Denver, and she basically went home and spent some time with her family. And it was a very, very difficult time. They didn't know where they were headed, but they continued to communicate, and the Lord brought them back together, and their marriage remained strong in the rest of their life. And one of the things that was just revealed recently is a letter that he wrote to her just hours before D-Day, where he expressed his love for her and how much she meant to him. And so, again, in the midst of all the struggles, he had the foundational understanding of the things that made this country great, faith and family and raising up those values.
Right.
And time and again, he said, you go through his speeches, Janet, and I wish we had time to just read, you know, a couple of these entire speeches to your audience. But he said, the only hope for the world will be complete spiritual regeneration. Hmm. He said that at the American Legion in 1945.
Amazing.
When he was chief of staff of the Army. Another time he talked about the spiritual weapons, which will be our country's most powerful resource in peace or war. He said the transcendence of our religious faith and our heritage and future is, he said, it's our past and our future. Without it, there isn't a future. Hmm. And another one he said was, a people that values its privileges above the principles soon lose both.
Ugh, that's good.
And I'll give you one more. The churches of America are the citadels of our faith and individual freedom and human dignity. And this strength is our matchless armor in the worldwide struggle against the forces of godless tyranny and oppression. I mean, this isn't just saying God bless America at the end of a talk.
No.
these were pivot points in the center. One of the other little tidbits is realizing the importance of prayer, not only doing it in the inaugural. He vowed that every cabinet meeting for his entire presidency was going to start with prayer. And he kept that promise for 8 years. I've got a little anecdote about one time when he forgot it in the book, and I'll leave that for the readers to discover.
Good. Oh, man. And again, this is an untold story of sorts. I certainly never knew that about Ike until I was reading through your book, because one of the things you note here, though, is that there is a strong argument to be made that Ike actually played a central role in nurturing a nationwide spiritual awakening. I thought that was quite a strong statement, but interesting. Why do you say that he was really a central player in a nationwide spiritual awakening? What are you referring to there?
Well, you think about several things that were going on at that time. First of all, Billy Graham was really just coming of age.
Yes.
We were years past, Billy Sunday. We were years past Dwight Moody. And by the way, there's some speculation, which I have in the book, that Dwight Eisenhower was named for Dwight L. Moody.
Oh.
But we were in a time where there was not a recognized individual spiritual leader, so to speak. And as I say, Billy Graham was on the rise. He was being recognized in the media. And he and Eisenhower formed this friendship, and they began to understand how important it was to work together on the different issues. Eisenhower, as I said earlier, understood that the fight against international communism and the Cold War would only be won by spiritual weapons, by faith in God, and by prayer, that everything else was meaningless without that foundation. And so he preached it. And when I say he preached it, I would challenge some of the listeners to just have fun and go online and read some of the speeches that have been digitized. And you will be surprised. Even his inaugural address is from a different era. And I think that, the nation responded well, and he continued to build. And eventually we saw a tone in the, the public polling was different in that era than it is now. It's hard to compare numbers and so forth exactly. But probably the zenith of expressed public faith in God and dependence on something beyond ourselves was in that period when he was president.
Incredible. That's incredible. And like Reagan, he used faith as a rhetorical weapon, you say, against communism and Soviet aggression. And many people will say, oh, I remember Reagan doing that. Not so much Eisenhower, perhaps.
Well, you know, again, people have their own memories of the era they lived through. But another thing is, in Eisenhower's era, we had three networks. We had ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Yes.
And in the community I grew up, Janet, we had two stations. We didn't have ABC. We had you could either watch Walter Cronkite with The Way It Was, or you could watch Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
That was it.
and that was it. But a little illustration people don't realize. After John F. Kennedy's assassination, a couple years later, everybody thinks back and they think everybody thought Kennedy was the greatest, and there was such mourning and sorrow and such love for Kennedy. Just a couple of years after Kennedy's assassination, there was a nationwide poll, and people said that they loved Eisenhower, and they would have elected him to a third term if it was possible. Mm-hmm. He actually was more popular than John Kennedy during the center of what people call the Camelot era.
Really interesting. That really says something. Well, and he was such a huge figure in terms of what he accomplished. You had mentioned Billy Graham, and something really struck me that you talked about in the book, and that was Billy Graham visiting President Eisenhower on his deathbed. And he claimed, Billy Graham claimed, that Eisenhower wanted him to tell him again how to be sure he was saved. And I thought, what a moment that must have been.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing like being in the condition he was, and after all of the heart attacks, the series of heart attacks he had, and being in Walter Reed that entire last year of his life, there's nothing that probably centers you on focusing on eternity like knowing you're going to be there.
Right.
And he just absolutely wanted to make sure that things were right with God. Mm. And Billy Graham writes about this account in one of his books where he talks about other presidents and other relationships. And this was the first president with whom he really formed that deep layer of friendship. And it worked in many other areas. One of the areas that people aren't aware of, the first Civil Rights Act, protecting the rights of African-American, Black Americans' right to vote, was passed under Dwight Eisenhower. Hmm. He desegregated Washington, D.C. You know, during World War II, he saw the performance, like the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yes.
and the black troops that were under his command. He actually took steps to eliminate much of the segregation for those that were under his command. And he saw this, and he saw this as a principle of morality that, you know, as creatures created by God, all of us must be treated fairly and properly. And so he stood up against many, many forces, and people always remember that he sent federal troops to the South for the first time after the Civil War, Reconstruction period, to Little Rock, Arkansas, mm-hmm. to defend the rights of those little boys and girls to attend school there. But what probably most people don't recognize is that he did it for moral reasons. He thought this is incredibly important morally, that we protect the constitutional and natural rights of all peoples, not just of the favored few.
Yes, that's a significant point. And it really is a thread that runs through the whole book, where you look at his presidency, you look at how he handled different situations, and his Christian faith really was the bedrock upon his life, and how he made a lot of decisions, even approving of Congress's decision to put Under God into the Pledge of Allegiance. That's a great aspect of his presidency that people will recall and can read about in the book called The Soul of an American President. Go ahead, Alan.
Just a few days ago, you recall the Supreme Court struck down an attempt to remove in God We Trust from our paper currency.
Absolutely.
Which he was also responsible for approving and signing.
Yeah, good point. Well, Alan Sears, so good to talk to you. Alan, thanks a lot for being here.
All right, Janet, it's always wonderful to hear your voice, and thank you for all you do.
Oh, you too. Thanks, Alan. We'll be back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Arbella Studios' Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com. We are back on Janet Meffer today. Is the media willing to tell the truth about Islam? Well, it seems to be the perennial question, and it matters significantly when we note the genocide that is occurring against Christians at the hands of Muslims around the world. Now, over on Fox News, Laura Ingraham recently got the perspective from a couple of so-called reformist Muslim women on the issue of persecution against Christians, but the results were sort of shocking. One of these Muslim women who appeared on the program, Asra Nomani, stated that the reason for the recent Sri Lankan terrorist attacks against Christians was a warped Saudi interpretation of Islam that misinterprets the Quranic directive to stay on the straight path. The other guest, reformist Muslim Kanta Ahmed, affirmed that notion. And you got to hear what she said. I'm going to play a cut. This is cut one.
That kind of interpretation, which is completely anathema to, I'm a Muslim child who was educated in a Christian school. My parents are in the 80s and they had a Christian education. So that's completely anathema to the teachings of Islam. It also is asking for Muslims to take actions into their own hands and then persecute for somebody's beliefs when Islam says everyone has a right to a free will, a right to reject Islam, to reject the truth of God in any way. So these Muslims are acting beyond the bounds.
Okay, is that really true? We're going to get some thoughts on it now from Islamic expert and author Dr. Andrew Bostom, who's written about this over at his website and says this is religious deception in action. Dr. Bostom, what is your take on this claim that these women are making on this show?
This is grotesquely inaccurate. And Kanta Ahmed, who was, I think, the more egregious of the two, went on to say that this persecution, which has been endemic to societies conquered by Islam since the advent of Islam, particularly Christian societies, is somehow, quote, anathema to Islam that reveres Jesus, that sees the gospel as a holy book of God. I mean, this is we have to go back. We have to go back. We must. We're being forced to. I've certainly been forced to for the last 17 years to go back and see what the Quran itself actually says, and what its classical to modern mainstream interpretations have said for over 13 centuries now. So, for example, what Asra Nomani, who typically is a little better on these subjects, said, she was referring to a specific verse that Muslims repeat 17 times a day, and it's very clear that verse, which has comes from the opening of the Quran called the Fatiha. It's the seventh of this very short opening chapter. It's the seventh verse. It talks about those who've incurred Allah's wrath, and those are the Jews, and those who've gone astray, and those are the Christians. And this is a very, very mainstream, repetitively reinforced gloss or interpretation on this verse, which comes initially from a Hadith of Muhammad, so words that Muhammad is the one originally who identified the two groups as being the Jews and the Christians. But beyond that, all the greatest classical Quranic commentators that I did a review recently, where 90% of the major commentaries from the 8th century through the present agree with that interpretation and reinforce it. So this is absolute nonsense to say it's the Saudis, it's the Turks, it's the Qataris. That's nonsense. But the theology of Islam is so fundamentally anti-Christian, and this is coming from a Jew who just has happened to study it.
Yeah.
The idea that beliefs that Christians hold so dear, so foundational, are rejected and criticized and denounced by Islam. So the so-called Muslim Jesus or Isa didn't die on the cross. And the reason that Muslims cite this is first of all, basically, Christians and Jews have corrupted their scriptures. That's Quran. That's the third surah, the 78th verse. So I want to give you shorthand on these verses, and people can look them up. The claim goes in three successive verses that first of all, Isa didn't die on the cross. The Jews killed him, or claimed they killed him. In reality, he wasn't killed or crucified. That's Quran 4:157. He was ascended to Allah. That's Quran 4:158, still alive. And on the resurrection day, 4:159, Isa himself will be a witness against Jews and Christians. That is, again, it undermines basic Christian belief, and it goes on. It's there are other core Christian beliefs. Isa isn't the son, and in fact, belief in a father God, a mother Mary, and Isa the son is a terrible heresy according to the Quran, which Isa himself allegedly rejected. That's the fifth surah, the 116th verse. The doctrine of the Trinity is not only a terrible disbelief; those who believe it are awaiting a painful doom. That's also in the fifth surah, the 73rd verse. Christians should basically accept Islam, and all true Christians will, because after all, Abraham was neither a Jew nor a Christian. He was a Muslim. That's in the third surah, the 67th verse. It is Muhammad who freed Christians and Jews from this kind of ignorance. That's in the 98th surah, the first to fourth verses. Christians and Jews should accept Muhammad as Allah's messenger and the Quran as the final revelation. That's in the 5th surah, the 15th verse, the 57th surah, the 28th verse, the 4th surah, the 47th verse. You know, a few Christians came to believe in Islam, and those are the only real Christians. That's in the 3rd surah, the 113th to 14th verses. And they submitted to Allah by accepting Muhammad. That's in the third verse, the third surah, the 198th to 199th verse. And of course, we have condemnation to hell for those who don't believe in these ideas that are anathema to Christianity, not anathema to Islam. That's in the 98th surah, the 6th verse. And therefore, Muslims are compelled to wage eternal jihad against Christians and Jews, those that actually believe in Christianity and Judaism, yeah, and compel them to live under Islamic law. That's in the 9th surah, the 29th verse. And even when they're submitted, living under the Sharia, Muslims are advised not to take Christians, legitimate Christians and Jews who actually believe in their own religions. They're advised not to take them as friends. And then, of course, you get to the end of times, and Isa comes back. You know, he's taken out of his abode, whatever, in the Quran. He comes back in the Hadith as a pious Muslim destroyer of Christianity. As it says in this canonical Hadith, he will break the cross, kill swine, and abolish the jizya. In other words, there'll be no more Christianity because Allah will perish all religions except Islam, it says in this canonical Hadith. And Jesus, Isa, the Muslim Jesus, will be the instrument of this, destroying what's the Islamic equivalent of the Antichrist, which is often identified as a Jew, by the way, but regardless, is always accompanied by Jewish minions.
Well, here's
I'm just giving you a quick walkthrough, and this is, you will never hear this on Fox News. Laura Ingraham can sit there. I don't care if she wears a cross that literally bends her neck over. You will never hear any of this on her show. And this is just an outrage when you combine that with the physical evidence that we have. If you look at Open Doors surveys every year, 90%, 95% of the worst persecuting countries for Christians are Islamic countries.
Right.
They had the temerity, Quanta Ahmed, to talk about Qatar. Yes, Qatar built a Catholic church back in 2008. Fox even reported about it. It's a bare structure that it has no church, it has no cross, has no bells, cannot ring bells. It's basically inside an enclosure. It's a dhimmi church, the way Sharia mandates that Christians practice
their faith.
It's just outrageous.
Why the taqiyya, though? Why do you think they get on and don't just cop to it when it's so anecdotally refutable, not just theologically refutable like you just did, but also when you look across the world and you say, really, if it's just a Wahhabiist outlier perspective, then why do you see Christians being killed in genocide at genocidal levels around the world?
Because we're supposed to believe that these people that they have on the show, who may have certain motives that we would both respect, I think they don't tell the truth out of embarrassment. But it begs the question. You raise the core issue. We have to be truthful about these things. And I think it's an obscenity now that this paradigm is that you have apologists like this on. And again, I'm not saying they're bad people necessarily. I think they're genuinely embarrassed by the truth. But regardless, that's not very helpful. No, to put it mildly. But the fact is that why isn't they led into the segment with a report about Raymond Ibrahim, who's a cop, who's fluent in Arabic, who's an excellent historian and a very sober commentator. It was his data that Laura led into this segment. So why not have Raymond on there
to
actually tell the truth about what's going on?
I know. You're exactly right. Or you're awesome. Dr. Andrew Bostom, check out andrewbostom.org for more information. Thanks a lot, Dr. Bostom, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. We encourage you to partner with enemies within the church and help them complete this important project. To learn how to help and to stay updated about the film, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com. And while you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. Enemieswithinthechurch.com.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
From Arbella Studios comes Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. A new documentary that examines the history of race relations in Charleston and the hope for healing that emerged out of a senseless act of terror.
That act of forgiving people is the greatest act of love that one could ever experience.
So I forgive you, my family forgive you.
Emmanuel, in theaters June 17th and 19th only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. Before I forget, because talking to Alan Sears, the founder of Alliance Defending Freedom, a little while ago on this show, reminded me that I just want to say a big thank you to each and every one of you who gave to our recent campaign to support the great work of Alliance Defending Freedom. Their attorneys do such phenomenal work. They do it at no cost to their clients, and you have so many victories that ADF has been able to take at all the court level and even at the Supreme Court level. I have just been so honored to work with them as I have over these many years that I've done talk radio. And I really appreciate if you were able to call and give a donation to help support their work and help these clients go to court and really fight for our religious liberty and fight for our rights to have marriage upheld as the institution that it is. Through our religious convictions. It's just really, really important that we stand with ADF. And you guys really did. We not only met our goal, we exceeded it. And I have you to thank. So thank you very, very, very much. We really appreciate it. You guys always come through anytime we come and ask, hey, can you support this ministry that we really believe in? You guys always, always make it happen. So thank you. And if you wanted to give and you just didn't have the opportunity to call, you can still make the call. It's 800-636-4042. That's 800-636-4042. And you can still make a donation to the Freedom Fund, which supports the great attorneys over at Alliance Defending Freedom. So thank you again. One more time, 800-636-4042. I want to move on to this story. This actually was an interview that was done over on Fox News with Laura Ingraham. Weird interview in some ways. It was an important interview, but it was an interview about these drag queen story hours that are becoming so pervasive across this country. Maybe not pervasive, but we're hearing more and more about additional drag queen story hours. I don't know what kind of self-respecting parent would take a child to something like that, but there are people who are doing it, and it's very, very wrong. It's weird that we live in a time where we actually have to make the argument, this is wrong, and not everybody sees why it's wrong just because of what it is. At any rate, the two people interviewed on the show were Arthur Schapper, who is the California director of Mass Resistance founded by Brian Kamenker, great friend, wonderful cultural warrior, and they just do fantastic work, especially with the Drag Queen Story Hours. And on the other side of the issue supporting the Drag Queen Story Hours, Jonathan Merritt. Now, do you know who Jonathan Merritt is? Jonathan Merritt is the son of James Merritt, the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And Jonathan Merritt, unfortunately, also had admitted several years ago to an inappropriate relationship with a male blogger back in 2012, I believe it was. He's very much a progressive. He's very much far left. He's a writer. He's written books and written for a lot of different websites. So just keep in mind who's for the Drag Queen Story Hours. This was very strange. But first of all, Arthur is asked what his main objection is to the Drag Queen Story Hours. This is cut one.
We have had parents contacting us all over the country about these perverse programs. I mean, the bottom line is this. You have adult homosexual men, adult entertainers going into a public library reading to children. I mean, that alone should not only be sending off alarms, but people should be, demanding this to be canceled even before it starts. Okay, we're not talking about diversity here. We're talking about deviance. We're talking about perverse and destructive lifestyles being animated or advertised to children as if it's normal.
He's right about that in that description, and I appreciate the moral outrage because you don't get enough of that sometimes on TV. Over to Jonathan Merritt, though, the son of the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who, according to Laura Ingram, supports these events. And she mentions, hey, you know, these really aren't organic events, locally organized. This was a movement that began in, surprise, surprise, San Francisco. So she asks Jonathan what his take is. This is cut two.
To me, where it began is really irrelevant. I think the question is what's happening in these events now? And I think you have a lot of people who are upset about it. They're upset about it because, and your guest, I think, articulated that perfectly, that they're disgusted by certain people in society, by the LGBT community, by drag queens, who, by the way, are not always a part of the LGBT community. And they feel that their children will be contaminated if they come into contact with these people. I think that's not a mainstream view. I don't even think many conservatives, I don't even think, agree with that anymore.
Okay, Jonathan, what in the world are you talking about? Do you like the language that he's using there? Oh, people think they're going to be contaminating their children and they're disgusted by certain people. And these drag queens are not always part of the LGBT community. Well, that's kind of funny because who in the world is all in favor of this but the LGBT community? And whose community are they a part of if they're not part of the LGBT community? For heaven's sakes, when you look back at the Stonewall riots, it was a bunch of, you know, homosexual people who were in the bar and rioting, including a lot of drag queens. I mean, I'm not really sure what that comment even means, but it does matter where this movement began. And it was interesting that Jonathan Merritt was trying to say that it doesn't matter that the Drag Queen Story Hours originated out of San Francisco. Are you kidding me? How in the world can that not be relevant to the discussion? Then the question comes up, what is the true point of importing drag queens into these libraries to read stories to kids? This is how Jonathan Merritt responded. Cut three.
Well, if you read these stories, if you read the stories that are coming out about these events and you listen to the individuals who are actually reading the stories who speak for themselves, they're saying, we were looking for a way to give back to the community. We are entertainers. We dance, we sing, we make merriment in various establishments, but we were looking for a way to give back, and they wanted to pour into the children of their community. These events are voluntary. Nobody's children are being forced to go and sit in front of a drag queen and listen to a storybook. They're going there because they want to give back to their community, and I think in the United States of America, anyone should be able to do that.
Well, oh, brother.
Yeah, Arthur, I'm with you. Oh, brother. What are you talking about? They make merriment? That's what drag queens do. They make merriment. That's an interesting way to describe it. And I like the altruistic bent there that Jonathan Merritt gives to the drag queens. Oh, they just want to give back to their community. Well, might I say, if you want to give back to your community, collect some canned goods, maybe, and donate them to the local food pantry, or go out and clean up litter off the highway. How is this giving back to your community? I know I'll read pro-homosexual literature to little kids. That's how I'm going to give back to my community. You'll recall I played the cut not too long ago of the drag queen in Louisiana who was upset because the drag queen story hour in that parish there, I think it was Lafayette, was all upset that people were protesting and said, we're trying to groom the next generation. We're trying to groom the next generation. Exactly. It's an indoctrination thing. We're going to make sure that little kids see this stuff as normal. And what self-respecting parent is going to say, sure, go ahead. Well, there are some who will because they've been indoctrinated themselves. They somehow equate this whole movement with the civil rights movement. It's just like that. It's nothing like that. As some great African-American Christians have already said, you know, don't equate your sin with my skin. And I just think it's very, very obvious. Now, Arthur gets in one last comment. This is Cut 4.
There are normal ways to do this. We're not talking about knitting. We're not talking about a Bible class. We're talking about degenerate, perverse entertainment. And not only that, not one but two sex offenders were exposed at one drag queen story hour in Houston, Texas. That's what our organization revealed.
Yep, exactly right. And we got to keep that in mind. Oh, they're just wanting to give back to their community. Well, you had sex offenders dressed up in drag going to the public library in Houston. Who would have unearthed that if not for mass resistance? So I was really glad to see him mention that. By the way, speaking of the Southern Baptist Convention, I wanted to do one little add-on because of what I had said at the tail end of last week about the Southern Baptist Convention's annual meeting and that horrible Resolution 9 on critical race theory and intersectionality. As it turns out, Stephen Feinstein, who is a pastor in the Southern Baptist Convention, put out a blog post and said, hey, by the way, I'm the one who authored that resolution, and I'm actually alarmed by critical race theory and intersectionality, and that resolution originally denounced it all. And he put out the original resolution in which he denounced critical race theory as unbiblical, denounced intersectionality as unbiblical, and upheld the biblical truth that we have reconciliation through Jesus Christ and we are not to embrace these worldly neo-Marxist philosophies. And here the resolutions committee at the Southern Baptist Convention takes this resolution, turns it on its head, and turns into a resolution basically that supports critical race theory and intersectionality, at least neutral a little bit, as analytical tools that could be used, but they're still subordinate to scripture. I mean, that is so sleazy. Can I just say that? It's just sleazy. You throw the resolution out if you don't want to support it, but don't rewrite it to say the opposite of what the original author wanted it to say. I'm telling you, the Southern Baptist Convention has some really important things it must deal with. Well, this hour of Janet Mefford Today brought to you by Arbella Studios' Emmanuel, the untold true story of hope and forgiveness in the wake of the Charleston church shooting tragedy. Emmanuel in theaters today and Wednesday only. More information is available at emmanuelmovie.com. Thanks a lot for joining us on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.